My name is Alfred. I am an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain its integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA, and since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary purpose other than alcoholism, we think it would be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Harry and Wilbur, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. If any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and understanding. Lola will read the preamble.
Good evening. My name is Lola and I'm an alcoholic. AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Thank you.
Please join me in a serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things that I cannot change, the courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Ricky S. will read the steps.
Hi, I'm Ricky. I'm an alcoholic. The 12 steps. 1, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked Him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Gordon D. will read the traditions.
My name is Gordon. I'm powerless over alcohol. Tradition 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Tradition 2, for our group, for our primary purpose, there is one but ultimate authority, a loving God as He may express Himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. Tradition 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Tradition 4, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups as AA as a whole. 5, each group has one but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprises. lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supported, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create special boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain the personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers, followed by our information break, and then our main speaker, who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Marnie R.
Hi, I'm Marnie, and I'm an alcoholic. My home group is Atlantic Group. My sponsor's name is Heidi, and I'm on step 9. And I'm usually really loud that a mic might not even be needed. Okay. If you are new, if this is your first meeting, I could totally relate because I remember around 11 months ago, my sobriety date is February 25th, 2006. I walked in here just to observe, and I was definitely, you know, definitely shocked. This is not what it looks like in the movies. You know, I'm picturing, you know, a bunch of homeless people in circles, really upset. And I walk in here and I'm like, everyone's really attractive. Like, everyone looks really good. And I was, you know, I was convinced I was different and you didn't understand. Because, and now I will share my experience with you. My parents who are here and my brother who is here, they are amazing. You know, I am such a fortunate woman because they're the best. There was no alcohol in my house. Alcoholism does run in my family, but there was never alcohol in the house. And when I was a kid, I was always the one who was, I want it now, give it to me now, I wanted it yesterday, and always quick to throw a temper tantrum. And powerlessness, like, that wasn't a word in my vocabulary because I didn't understand it. I mean, 13, I planned my bat mitzvah, and it rained, and I went nuts. You know, it wasn't fair that it was raining. So I think these isms started from the beginning. And in high school, you know, I was always out there. I was friends with everybody. But I was, you know, I wasn't really into drinking. And I just drank to really be accepted because that's what my friends were doing. And I didn't, you know, I was just kind of going with the flow. And I knew my ticket out of town in Long Island would be college. So I worked really hard in high school, and I was, you know, this crazy perfectionist and leader of this, leader of that, that my parents were never hard on me because I was hard on myself. Like, literally, the hammer was, you know, going down. I would kick a wall. So I got, you know, my arrival was college. I went to the University of Michigan, and yeah, the party school, the football, the sororities, where, you know, this is where I became Party Marnie. This is where I arrived because, you know, no longer was I following the crowd. I was taking the crowd with me. You know, it was like, try this, try that. I'll throw this party. It's like I wanted to run the show and I wanted to be the star of the show. That is how it went. And that's how it went from that point on. It was always me, 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 me. I never had any concept of a higher power or of a God because that God was me. I mean, what I said went. And my friends kind of just followed. And when I got out of college, you know, I thought, New York City, here I come. The partying would kind of stop because I would be working. And I started working, and I was a very driven person. And I loved work, and I loved dressing up, and I loved going to work and being a New York City girl. And And, you know, the weekends I drank like the normal, you know, 22-year-old and the normal nights with my friends. And then I got, this is where it gets hard. Then I got diagnosed with MS, which is multiple sclerosis, which some of you may be surprised because I don't look like I could be ill, which really is how alcoholism is, you know. I didn't know I was an alcoholic because I was very functional. You know, I went to work every day. I never drank alone. I looked good. You know, I woke up. I went to the gym. I didn't think I had a problem. And when I got diagnosed, it was like, I do not want to deal with life on life's terms. I am 23. I'm a party girl, and no one is going to tell me that I can't drink. And the first question that I asked the doctors when I was diagnosed was, so can I drink? And they were like, you can drink moderately. And I was like, okay, what's moderate? Because I'm all or nothing. I knew that was me. You know, I mean, I would harp on this, like, can I drink? So I saw a second opinion. And I said to the doctor, can I drink? And my parents were sitting there like, oh my God. Like, you know, my dad would say, and I love this dad, he would go, can't you have a soda and spin around a few times? And I would say, no, Dad, I can't. Like, I really can't. It's just different. You know, and I didn't listen to the doctors. It didn't matter. And there I was. I was always the last person at the club. You know, I noticed, looking back, I had a big fear of being alone. You know, I always went home. I never went home by myself. I got involved with horrible men. Close your ears. La, la, la. So I did things that, you know, I thought at the time I was having a good time, and I was having a blast, but I was alone, you know, I didn't want to feel, you know, I didn't want to deal with anything, and I thought, you know, nobody understood me, and, you know, you don't have to drink alone to be an alcoholic. It's what happened when I did drink, and I was doing insane things. I fell down one night, my brother caught me, I was unconscious, I sprained my ankle, and I went to Vegas 2 days later, and I thought, well, if I'm in pain, I'll just drink. And that's what I did. I drank, and I wore the bandage during the day, and I took the bandage off at night, and I just drank. So that's how it went. And, you know, and every time I fell, the doctors were like, you know, I'm like, it's my MS. You know, I pull that MS card out, and they were like, well, were you drunk? And I'd be like, yeah, I think I was, you know, or I was hungover. I'm tired. So one day the doctor, he pulled my mom aside, and he said, she's got to stop. And that was like, all right. So I knew my cousin that many of you know, Jen. She's in the rooms, and she's awesome because she never, like, put, you know, she never really talked about it. And I just kind of called her, and it brings us back to, you know, this meeting. I said, I'm going to come and observe a meeting. And she said, all right, 60th and Park, 6:30, you know, come. So I come to observe, and I'm sitting right over there. I will never forget this. And I hear the speaker, and obviously I don't really hear what the person's saying. So listen, newcomers, try to listen. And I remember the guy who spoke said he was from Oceanside. And I was like, oh my God, that's my town. Oh my God, I'm an alcoholic. Like, that's what was going through my head. Oh no, I relate. He's from my town. I mean, these are the little things I remember. And the meeting ended, and we were on the way to thank the speaker. And all of a sudden, I just started crying. And the tears they were just coming out. And I turn to all these women over there, and I go, you don't understand. I am a party girl. This is what I do. My friends turn to me. They need to know where to go. I make the reservation. This is my life. And this girl turns to me, and she says, honey, that's what we all are. And it was like, oh, like moments of clarity. I was like, oh, my God. These are the top party people in Manhattan. Oh, my God. I need to get in this club. And from that day on, whatever you said, I did. I listened. You know, literally, that meeting, I went to a meeting every day. I mean, I just did whatever was told. Because I knew, for me, I had to stop. You know, I was powerless. I'm powerless over that drink. I'm not powerless over my MS. You know, I have no control over that. I am powerless over my MS. I am not powerless over the recovery of alcoholism. So I was like, all right, I'm just going to throw myself in here. And I remember I was counting days, and I was miserable. I mean, I was sad, and my mom would be like, oh my God, you're so sad, because I was always this happy person. And it was like, I thought my life was over. I thought there will never be fun. How am I going to live without drinking? How am I going to date? How am I going to get married, even though I don't have a boyfriend? You know, it's like, how do we do these things without drinking? And wow, that's all I have to say. I don't know if you know, some people know me here, and life is just amazing. You know, I'm going to Sober Club Med Mexico in 2 weeks. I went through a New Year's Eve sober party, you know. I'm doing the step work. I call my sponsor every day, and things got so much better. It's like I'm awake. I am so aware. And instead of waking up and wondering if I did have fun last night, I know I had fun because I felt everything, and it was awesome. And there's such awesome people here. And I hope if you're new, oh, my God, just come back. I promise you it gets better. Thank you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Jeff C.
I'm an alcoholic. My name's Jeff. Whew. That was great, Marnie. Chris, thanks for asking me to speak. It's a privilege. And thanks everyone who did service tonight for setting up a great meeting. Oh man, you're never quite prepared for facing the crowd. About 5 years ago was the last time I took a drink, January of 2002. I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous until a year and a half later. January 2002, I was informed by my therapist that if I didn't stop drinking and go to AA, that he basically issued me a choice. He said, you can either continue seeing me or you can go get some help, because I was wasting both of our time. And so I did what he said. This was that moment that I needed someone to push me. And so I audited AA for about a year and a half. In that time I came to about 5 meetings, and I didn't, which isn't even really auditing, is it? I mean, that's sort of, I don't know. I hadn't really lost enough. You know, things hadn't quite gotten bad enough. I was still uncertain about, you know, because I came into AA kind of knowing everything. I knew what alcoholism was. I knew what the problems were. I knew everything. And so I wasn't interested really in listening to what anyone had to say. And I wasn't interested in, I didn't quite get that concept of identifying instead of comparing. I would compare myself very specifically to people, find the things that were different about us, and then leave the room. Convinced that there was nothing here for me, that there was no one, you know, that there was nothing here for me. So that went on, and then after a while, and then I guess I was at a meeting, it was April of 2003, and they read the first step, and they talked about how, you know, regardless of how far down the scale we've gone, we can find that our experience can be helpful to other people, and I heard that, and so that was the first night where I really asked someone for help. I said, I don't know what I'm doing, I need some help, what do I do? And they told me, they said, find a meeting in your neighborhood, you know, start going to that meeting, start raising your hand and saying you're counting days, start counting from now, you know, welcome to day one, even though you've been abstinent for, you know, for a year and a half, it doesn't matter. Just start now and just get going. Get yourself a sponsor and move forward from there. So that's what I did. And so I went to a meeting in my neighborhood. Of course, I tried to be as careful as possible because everyone was watching everything that I was doing. And so everyone was very curious as to why I was going to an AA meeting. You know, I didn't want to be seen walking in, coming out, anything. And things started changing from there. I got the immediate benefits of coming to AA, being with a group of people, hearing the stories, you know, and starting to meet people and get into that. And it was cool for a little while. And then what ended up happening was there was something kind of you know, alcoholism, what I've come to learn about it is that there's a certain sort of mindset, a certain insanity that precedes all of the drinking that we do. We have this way of looking at the world that's a little bit off. And so that was all still there. All of my insecurities, all my fears, all my shame, all my embarrassment, all of that stuff was still there. The only difference was that I wasn't drinking now. And I really wasn't doing anything to change any of that stuff. So what ultimately ended up happening was I started catching up with me. And I needed to start doing things differently. And I didn't really know how to do that. And I met someone who spoke at a meeting and who was talking about the actions that he took, the things that he did. After a short period of time, some calls back and forth, I was still kind of doing it my way. And then I called him one day and asked him to be my sponsor. Actually, the man that I was working with as a sponsor, he had started drinking again. And so I called Mark. And so my sponsor today is Mark P. And he's been tremendous because over the last 3 years, what we've been doing is just trying to get into the discipline of a new way of doing things. It started with me calling him every day. It started with us getting together every week to go through the big book, the 12 and 12, doing the step work, and just doing basically what the book said to do. And things started changing very gradually. Alcoholism is a progressive illness. When I was drinking, it was progressive. The first time I had a drink, I wasn't like, this is it, you know, this is the, you know, it happened progressively over time. It was the same way with AA. When I came here for the first time, I didn't think I was, you know, I wasn't so excited about it, and things have happened progressively over time. What can I say about the last, you know, I've been working with Mark for 3 years, and over those 3 years, everything has changed. I was pretty much, I had a lot of, like, I was unemployable. I mean, I had a job, but it was pretty much like I wasn't really doing a whole lot, which was perfect for early sobriety. I could go to meetings. I could make phone calls. I did all the things that Mark asked me to do. And those things were very simple. He said, you know, we can work together provided you make a commitment to do the following things. He said, pray in the morning, pray at night. Call me every day. Every day. Not like, you know, you're an alcoholic 5 days a week and on the weekends you're not. Get service commitments, minimum three. Go to a meeting every day. Call three other sober men every day, and make a commitment that after he had brought me through the work, that I would then bring others through the work. And to the best of my ability, I've been trying to do those things. And that's basically like, welcome to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I mean, that's it. It's not a horribly onerous task, you know. It's these little things that we can do on a day-by-day basis that change us, and then, you know, and then everything gets better. The steps were really complicated, and I'm a heavy thinker, and I would really kind of like want to get into all these things. And I found that over time, what I realized was that the steps were really things that I'd been doing all along anyway. I just needed to kind of shift my focus. Particularly with steps 2 and 3, the belief in a higher power, and then turning will and life over to the care of that higher power. I would turn my will and my life over the care of, you know, if you told me to drink it, smoke it, snort it, like, I would do it, you know, no questions asked. The first time that, you know, someone told me, like, I want you to pray every day, I want you to do it, I was like, suddenly I became really careful about my well-being. You know, suddenly I became very tentative and wondering, like, well, what's in that for me exactly? You know, what's going to happen if I do that? And, you know, because I did what was convenient, you know. But things, you know, I don't even know where to start. I mean, you know, I have a life today that is basically more than I could ask for. And the life today that I have is because of Alcoholics Anonymous and because of the belief in a higher power and nothing more. You know, as long as I continue to do these things and do them, you know, and just do them one day at a time, then all these wonderful things happen. You know, the job thing changed. I'm in a job now that, you know, do I know if it's like the end all be all? Perhaps not. You know, but it's certainly better than it was. I'm in a relationship today. You know, I got engaged in December, which was, I was not relationship material when I came in here. You know, all of these things that I never thought, and I'm sure that if you're counting days or you're not working a program or something, you are thrilled for me, you know, because when I first came, like, I was thrilled for the people who had, you know, who had these wonderful lives. You know, I resented everyone. I was sitting there stewing, trying to figure out, you know, plotting my escape from Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it was really, I just couldn't relax, you know. And then over time, you know, again, what I found, at least, you know, my experience to this day has been that having time away from drinking and drugs is great. But without working a program, it's kind of a half measure. Also, being fully immersed in the AA material and knowing all of those things is great. But without time and without living these things and practicing them, you know, it's certainly better, but you need both things. Like, it doesn't happen overnight. It won't happen this weekend. It's going to happen, you know, progressively and steadily with that horrible D word, that discipline, on a daily basis, doing these things. You know, the list of one of the other things, a practical thing you can do is to do gratitude lists. Do the things that you're grateful for on a nightly basis, which is, you know, all of these tools are just tremendous things that were brought to me, and, you know, I benefit from the experience of my sponsor and his sponsor, and, you know, this program has been around for 70 years, and people have heard things from speakers from all over the country, all over the world, and I benefit from that, and I get to hear people sort of, you know, relay those things to me. So if you're new or if you're not sure what's going on, doing these things has benefits for everyone, and so if you come in and just start doing the work, trust me, things change and they get better. Thanks.
Our main speaker tonight is Mary.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Mary, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm a very proud member of the Cerebral Victories group. And you people, the Atlantic group, are a bunch of good-looking folks, I'll tell you. You really are. It's really a pleasure to be here. I came from a wonderful, wonderful family. I had three brothers, two sisters, and a mom and dad. And there was never, like you, there was never any alcohol in our home. My father was a real estate developer, and with that, he had built alleys and ran them and so on, the skating rink, had cocktail lounge, tap room, which we were never allowed to go in there. I can remember going behind the bar on a Saturday morning and put my finger there where the tap was, just to taste it. But my grandmother had died on the streets of Denver. I only found this out a few years ago because everything was kept so quiet and didn't even talk about it. Well, I can remember when I was probably third, fourth, fifth grade, whatever it might be. We used to have the missionaries that came. And on Saturday, we'd be in the church and we would have to take a vow, a pledge, where we'd put our hand up and swear we wouldn't have a drink until we were 21. And I knew that if they say I shouldn't have it, I crossed my fingers behind my back and I put my hand up. But I didn't have a drink. I'd never drank until I was 21. And when I grew up, it was through the 40s and World War II and the big bands and went to see them all. And you kids don't know what you're missing, because it was wonderful. As I said, Daddy had built the rink, and I hated it when he built it, because he knew how much I liked it. And he used to go and watch me, and so he said, it's good for the kids. He felt. So he built one, and I thought, now, he's trapping me, because I'm going to have to be there. But it was a wonderful place, and a lot of kids got a lot of fun out of it, and that was where I met my husband. He was working for Daddy as a guard, and, you know, one of those handsome-looking guys that skate backwards until you slow down, until you went a little faster so they'd get your attention. And my dad loved Bus. We called him Bus. My dad loved him. He was a good worker until I started going with him. And he hated him. I mean, hated him. Well, poor Buzz, he had only gone to be a sophomore in high school. And I had gone through, Daddy believed in education for each and every one of us. And I had gone the whole nine yards up through college. We were so Irish. So Irish. I tainted the blood. Because Buzz was German and English. And anybody that's Irish knows what that is. And he was a Methodist. Yeah. And I was Catholic. And I'll tell you, my father was not a happy... Oh, and over and above that, I was 3 years older than him. So Buzz was quite young. But we were going to get married, and that was all there was to it. It was in 45. And even the priest went down and talked to Daddy. Daddy said no. So we went up to the rectory, got married. And Mom and Dad stayed home and cried. And then when we came back, Daddy says, where are you going to live? Well, we didn't. You couldn't rent a room at that time. You people are all too young. You don't remember all this. So it ended up Daddy bought a house for us in Irvington, which was beautiful at the time. And we had to go to court. I can't tell you how many times. And so the way Daddy had it set up was I was to stay home with Mom and Dad. And Bust was to stay with his folks. And he was never allowed to stay over. But by the time we got in the house, I was on my third kid. You talk about the Immaculate Conception. And we got in, and where I kept right on going, I had five kids in 5 years, and I skipped a year. You know, that was it. But, you know, I was a good mom. I was a good mom. I was great with the kids. And the reason was I wasn't dependent on booze. We used to go out and have a good time, play shuffleboard. We had the piano bars and sit around them and sing. I started out as a second soprano, ended up practically a bass because I used to love it so much. But it was good times. And I can honestly remember when Buzz got this one particular job and he was making $100 a week. $100. I'll never have to worry about money again. That was my thoughts. And it was good. And we had boats. That was one thing my husband insisted on because his dad always had them. And there were a lot of good times. And again, I never became dependent on the booze. But that man, my dad, got very ill and had cancer. And he was in a hospital up in All Souls in Marshtown for a year and a half. Today, they never allow anything like that. It was, when we look back, it was almost cruel because we had nurses around the clock. In fact, we had two rooms. One room we went in and stayed in. And I remember so well coming up from Irvington, going up Morris Avenue, and I stopped and I bought a bottle. Now, you see, when we had the boat, I drank with my husband, but we only drank on the boat. And like I said, it was fun. I couldn't tell you what I bought, didn't open it up right then, went up to the hospital, saw Daddy, came home, and I snuck that bottle in the house and put it under my pillow. And I drank that bottle that night. And you know, my husband wasn't even home. He was working. But right from the beginning, I had to hide. I had to hide it. And when I took that bottle, I know that was when I started a dependency on booze. It was very slow, but it was very deliberate. Very, very deliberate. And went on for quite some time. Lots of things happened where my kids got mad at me and so on. But I couldn't understand what they were. I was a good mom. I was out working at the time. I was making more money than my husband. Kids didn't want for anything. And at this point now, you know, you all have to have cars. They're in school. And I went into this one particular job, the last job I worked at, and I had worked there for quite some time. And I had a staff working for me, and it was an American Supply House for hospitals. Came in, and saw an order on my desk that was probably about 8, 9, 10 pages. So it was quite sizable. And I couldn't read a bloody word of it. Because I had started to bring bottles into work. You know, I always made sure my pocketbooks, big pocketbooks, lots of zippers, so that when I opened the bottom drawer and left my pocketbook out, people going by, she's not drinking, there's nothing in her pocketbook. This is where my thinking was. And the phone rang, and it happened to be the fellow that had called me about the order the day before. I said, oh, Guy, I'm so glad you called. I have the order right in front of me. I said, let's go over it once again. He said, Mary, we went over it twice yesterday. See, I'm drinking at work. And I didn't remember a thing. So I said, come on, let's go through once more. I want to make sure everything is just right, which he did. And at that time, the computer room was half the size of this, not these little laptops that they have today. And I processed the order, went right up and brought it in myself, stopped the personnel on the way, went in, told them I had a heart condition, was taking a leave of absence, and I walked out. That's what alcoholics do. We are so selfish. I knew that the booze had gotten to me. I loved my job, and I wasn't going to let anything interfere with it, and if it did, it had to go. That was all there was to it. When I got home, went right up to my room. Kids went to wake me up the next day, told me I wasn't going to work anymore. What? Imagine how my husband felt. Like I said, I had kids in college, one beauty school. And then I just continued drinking. And he did everything. You know, trying to help me. He wouldn't give me cash, but he gave me a checkbook, and he thought he'd have me cornered with the checkbook. Tell us, alcoholic. You know, strip us naked, put us in the middle of Times Square. We're going to get that bottle come hell or high water. And that's what I did with that checkbook. I'd go up to the Pathmark. Now I'm feeding 7 people, buy the cheapest cuts of meat. To this day, if you say puff rice, my kids go into a tizzy. And if the bill came to, say, $47.24, at that time, Pathmark didn't care, you know, what the size of the check was. And I would make it out $97.42. It was important to put the cents in. And Bus never figured it out. Never figured it out. So as things are going on, you know, all my drinking, it never bothered me. It did not bother my family, but it didn't bother me. I mean, it was just the way I was. If they didn't like it, it was just too bad. And then I can remember going up to see my mom. My mom got sick, and she had a stroke. And she was completely paralyzed and couldn't speak. And I thought I was going to take care of her. And I brought her home and had a bed put up down the rec room. Did everything. Got trapezes. My God, the poor woman couldn't even sit up. Got everything needed to be. I was doing all those things, changing catheters. I could have killed her. I really could have killed her. And I remember Bus talking to me one day. He says, you know, I'm going to tell your brothers you're drinking. And I said, go ahead. You know, I knew that he wouldn't do it. I knew that he would not tell my brothers that their sister was a drunk. So I had it home free. But out of that, my youngest daughter was acting very, very strange. And I had the doctor who I had coming in to see Mom take a look at her. And she was staying in the room, and we couldn't do much with her. She was 25 years old. And he took one look at her, and he said, get her immediately up to Dr. Calco, who was a neurosurgeon. Find out that later on that she had a 4-centimeter tumor in the brain, and it was right in the motor works. And up we went. She was operated on. She was in intensive care for 2 weeks, and they watched me like a hawk. I couldn't get a drink if I wanted to. And I stayed there, and I shook, but I stayed. And then they put her in a room by herself. And I don't know how I got the keys. I don't even know which car. But I took it and went home, stopped at a liquor store on the way, probably bought about 3 or 4 bottles, I can't tell you how many. Went home, up to my room, and I'd always told my kids, when that door is shut, nobody's to come in. And there I stayed, I don't know how long, 3 days, 4 days. And the kids came into that room, and they said, Mommy, you've got to get up to the hospital. Irene is looking for you. See, Irene, she couldn't talk, she couldn't walk, she couldn't do anything. It took her 18 years to learn how to read. And, you know, they didn't understand the pain I was going through. Everything was happening to me. Forget about Irene, what she was going. I was the one that was suffering. It was my kid. And nobody could understand this. And the only thing that was giving me any kind of comfort was a couple of drinks. And they were taking it away from me. So I got dressed and I went up and went in the room. As I said, she couldn't speak. And she looked at me and she said, you drunk. Then I was really mad. I was hurt. My feelings were so hurt that I stormed out of that place. And the kid said, Mommy, that's just what you deserve. I bought my last bottle when I was going up to see my mom. And I remember buying the bottle, but I don't remember putting it up to my lips. And I came to, that was 10 o'clock in the morning, I could time it because that's when liquor stores open. That's when the bank opened because they cashed a check. And I came to, and I was sitting across a desk from a woman. And she was talking to me, and I was talking to her to find out. I was in Beth Israel Hospital in Newark. I had a little tiny scratch here. There were a couple men in back of me to find out that they were state troopers. And one said to the other, I think she was trying to kill herself. And the other one said, no, she just didn't care. In that short time, that man could recognize me. And then shortly after, my kids came in with their husbands because they had gone in my pocketbook, found out who I was, called my daughters, and they came parading in to get their drunken mother. In the meantime, they got in touch with this is before cells, you know, no cell phones. They got in touch with their father who was working and told him, Daddy, don't come home tonight. Go down to the boat. We started off with an 18-footer and ended up with a 40-footer, and boats were his life. He enjoyed it. So down to the boat he went that night because, God forbid, if he came home, one of us would have been dead. And I probably would have been the end killing him because I didn't care. So I have Irene downstairs wondering what I'm going to do with her. Nobody giving me any kind of sympathy whatsoever what I was going through. They honestly didn't care. So that morning I figured, Carter was president, and I remembered Mrs. Carter. She was in charge of the Peace Corps. That's where I'm going to go. I got hold of Washington. I got hold of him. I spoke to a man. Want to know when I'd be available to go? I said, immediately, I can pack my bags. And apparently I gave him my name and address. I don't remember that. And then he said to me, how old are you? And at the time, I was in my mid-50s. And I told him, mid-50s. You're too old. You can't come. I said, Mrs. Carter, she's older than I am, and she's in charge of the whole thing. What do you mean I can't? You know, they sent me papers. But by that time, my kids, they were the ones who were sick and tired of being sick and tired. They had had it. And they had been to meetings. They knew all about AA. And the thing that they didn't know was about meeting books. And so what they did, they called up all the police stations around, find out where the meetings were, came and got me, and I wasn't talking to them. Not for what they were doing to me. Get in the car, Kathy had come up from Freehold, Teresa from Madawan, Peggy was still home, and every night they took me to a meeting. It was funny, when I was celebrating 25 years, I was mentioning about the kids taking me to the meetings, and I said, here they come, drop me off, go all the way home, come back to pick me up. And Peggy stood up and she said, Mommy, we never left that parking lot. We were afraid you were going to bolt. I got a wonderful indoctrination. Wonderful. Well, my first sponsor was a man, Marty Monahan. And because I joined the Spotswood group, because that's what they said to do. And when I went into the meeting, he took one look at me and he figured I was just going to ruin the integrity of the group completely from the way I acted and everything else. Mind you, I mean, my face is out of here. I got a hairpiece that's up on the top. I was not a pretty picture. Trust me. And it was only maybe about 7 years before Marty died that he finally admitted that in the beginning he was my sponsor. Because I learned so much from Marty. And so that went on. And Irene started to get better, and we had the therapy and so on. And time went on, and I enjoyed. I hated AA to start with. I really did. I didn't belong there. There was nothing there for me. Anything I heard, I could figure that out myself. But what Marty did, he put me in charge of lemonade. We never had lemonade. But that was my job, to get fresh lemonade on our Monday night meeting. And so I was the one that had to go squeezing them. No cans. But he gave me all kinds of jobs like that so that I would come. And I remember when they nominated me secretary of the group. And this one girl, Joni, she had had it for years. And I said, well, it's about time they gave us somebody that's got some talent and experience. I'll get these books straightened out one way or the other. We lost Mom. We lost my husband. And in 95, we were getting ready to go to San Diego. And I made all the different internationals, which are incredible. If you didn't get up to Toronto this last time when it was so close, you missed something. But in 10, it's going to be down in San Antonio, and I'll probably have a cane walking along, but I'll be there. And that little girl, she started getting very sick. We had doctors all over the place, couldn't find out what was wrong with her. It took a long, long time, but to find out that she had cancer. And it was in her duodenum, which I had never heard of. And it took a long time for them to find it. And she was operated on January the 6th in 1995. And I had had problems with the surgeon because I wanted her to get in earlier, and he didn't consider it an emergency. And when he came out, it was supposed to be like an 8 to 9 hour surgery, removing part of her stomach, you know, the whole thing. And came out after 2.5 hours, and he looked me right in the eye, and he said, she's going to die. And I said, well, now would we consider this an emergency? And I wouldn't let that man near her again. And I was the one that told her that she had cancer. And I was able to do it in a way that she understood, because she had trouble understanding. But she had so much faith, that kid. She had so much faith. And she loved people. And during that time, she taught me. But prior to that, I was having a terrible time with the third step. Terrible time. And I was sponsoring girls, and I would tell them, I can help you with so many things, but I can't help you with the third step. I had found a God, I thought, but then I figured I got to find him a home, and I didn't know what home I was going to put him in. I'm not alone in this. I know I've gone to every religion going to find out which one was the best one. And it ended up where I started out was where I went to. But she taught me how to have faith. How to have faith. And she taught me how to be a good mom. She came home from the hospital in August. She had had surgeries, anything she wanted that we did. Nothing was pressured on her. And she said, Mommy, no more needles. I said, honey, there'll be no more needles. And she was up in that bed, and she was never alone in that bed until we lost her. But that was on October the 11th in 95. But prior to that, she wanted me to go out to that convention. Mommy, you always win. I'll be okay here. And so the girls wanted to stay with her. I'm not going to be babysat. Not going to be babysat. And I gave Kathy my credit card. Give Kathy the credit card. You have no idea what happens to a credit card when she gets hold of it. But what we decided to do, we'll do the house all over. Get special paint, so she will, and then they'll have to be there to supervise the people doing things. So she will. All new furniture, all new this and all that. Then Irene was part of it because she wasn't babysat. The house was being taken care of while I was gone. And that day, when we were in bed, and we just poured morphine down her throat. That's what we got from the nurse. Because she had had enough pain. She couldn't take any more pain, that tiny little thing, than that. And then she said, just looked at us. And Kathy looked at me and she said, Mommy, she's gone. I learned in those 11 months how to be a mom. When I went to my step meetings, it was amazing how I heard words I had never heard before. And I can't tell you how many, I was 17 years in the program at the time. And I can't tell you how many times I went through those steps. I went to big book meetings, and there was always something, some word or some expression that I needed just to get through that day. And again, I was a good mom. You know, we never had one regret, not one regret with Irene. That was to do, be expanded, because everybody in our group, everybody around, everybody knew Irene. Irene, truly, she was a mini-church, but she was a pain in the ass. But she was our pain in the ass because of the trouble that she had with the surgery and slamming doors and getting mad. And now she could get all kinds of laughs going back, thinking about her and talking about her. But she was such an example that I finally, truly found my God. And then I had a home for him, and he's quite comfortable. And now I have two great-grandchildren that their parents don't take them to churches that I would care for or bless themselves the way I would like to see them. But Christopher is going to make his first communion, so it's mandatory now. But I take them to church, and we had the Advent wreath, and the kids are learning. And they say their prayers. And that's because Irene and AA taught me to be able to teach not only my children, not only my grandchildren, but my great-grandchildren. You know, I look at it so often and look at all the people. I've seen so many people through the years. And each and every person truly has helped me. And I always remember that what you people in AA and in all the rooms in another country have done, they took a broken woman, a shattered woman, put her back together again, and gave her back to her family. And we all thank you for that. Thank you.
My name is Helen. I'm an alcoholic, and I chair the Atlanta Group. Good evening. Let's all thank our speakers, Marnie, Jeff, and Mary.